Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
And we're here with you with The Positive Mind. Bring you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Positively minded life. Today is a very special day. Today is Pi Day. Pi Day. Yes, I look forward to Pi Day every year for my own reasons. But I also look forward to Pi Day because Pi Day is March 14th, 314. Significant numbers because it is also Albert Einstein's birthday. Day of his birth. Now, by coincidence, 3.14 is pi, 22/7, if you remember from your mathematics. And pi is very significant because pi was one of the major fundamental mathematical formulas that helped solve so many things, especially as it relates to all circles. Pi points out the relationship between a circumference and a radius, and it's a formula that is absolutely amazing, with digits following the decimal that are never repeated. It's amazing. It's 3.14159265 3539, and it keeps going on and on and on and on and on. There are so many numbers following the decimal, you would think eventually it would have to stop. Krishan Ohao from one country was able to memorize 43,000 different numbers following the decimal, whereas Chao Lu of China knew 67,890 just in his head alone, following 3.14, 3.14159265. So what's the big deal? Why Pi Day? And what is important about Pi Day? All over the earth, the universities that focus on mathematics, they have Pi Days, because it's 3.14, and they help celebrate Albert Einstein by doing what? What do you think they do, Roberta?
They eat pie.
They eat pie, yes.
That makes sense.
Everybody eats pie. If you're going to be out tonight, have a piece of pie in honor of Albert Einstein. Now, Albert Einstein, I want to talk about him because a unique guy.
Yes, very unusual person.
You know? I'll quote. He said in his Rational Temperament, one of his writings, "To me it suffices to wonder at the secrets and to attempt humbly to grasp with my mind a mere image of the lofty structure of all that there is." And here's what he's saying. He's saying, I humbly am trying to imagine everything.
He says, to me it suffices to wonder. He enjoyed the wonder of it all. His mind would just wander in the universe and try to make sense out of things. Isn't it Albert Einstein who said that he was trying to figure out the mind of God as he was exploring the mathematical equations of that you know express the universe and its secrets? It was something about playing dice.
Playing dice. God does not play dice.
Right. There we go.
But it's in the same place. So Albert Einstein, a strange guy, 5 in the Enneagram. Clearly, those of you who know the Enneagram, 1932, he wrote a thing called My Credo. And the essence of his fascination with science, you know, his fascination, but his primary fascination was, what is all of it about?
Right.
And he tried to grasp, do you ever try to grasp it? I mean, Roberta and I were talking right before the program. Yeah. You know, I spend a lot of time trying to grasp it. What's it all? Not does it just make sense, but what's it all? And this is what Einstein did in his unified field theory, or the attempt to solve the unified field theory. This is the belief. This is the theory that there is a unifying force that helps us understand everything.
Well, okay, you said a lot there, Armand, and let me start by saying that in at least in my view, Einstein was first and foremost a philosopher who happened to have a very mathematical mind, a gifted mind with mathematics. And so he spoke the language of mathematics and expressed himself in mathematical verse. He was a very unsuccessful student. He was considered a slow learner. In fact, at the beginning of his academic career, he was considered learning disabled. Even.
Yes, he dropped out of secondary school.
He dropped out of secondary school, and he was teased to no end for his, quote, slowness of thinking. He was very shy and withdrawn and introverted and not socially, smart in any way. And he had difficulties graduating. He did not graduate college. He went to a technical school and ended up with a teaching diploma. But then when he went and applied for a teaching position, he was rejected and, someone else was hired instead of him.
He got a job at the post office.
He had got a job at the post office. No, at the patent office.
Swiss patent office.
Right. So at the beginning of his life, Einstein was a person that, not very impressive in his success in any field whatsoever. And then, while he was working in the patent office,
actually, as a teenager, kids, other nerds, got the fact that he had some unusual thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And this weird guy, this strange guy, shy and introverted, detached completely from everybody else, who forgot to put on his socks sometimes, even though he put on his shoes, that they knew there was something odd about this fella, and he became popular. Not as just being criticized and laughed at. He became popular as an unusual guy over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, it was hard not to notice that there was something special about this person. Now, we're not here idolizing Albert Einstein because I think there were parts that he missed. I think there were parts that he could have done in this universe to help this universe a little more. But there is something remarkable about his discoveries and what they could have done for us.
Sure. I mean,
and what they did do for us, actually.
Yes. He certainly was the first one who opened the door for the minds of the masses, to see a window into physics in such a way that people finally started to get the message that things are not the way they appear to be. That, in fact, there is one reality that is what we perceive, and it's the reality that we describe and that we share and that we agree on. And then there is a reality that is not accessible through the senses, but it is accessible through the mind. And it's a reality that he started out imagining at first, and then he set out to prove, and his life really was spent in this glorious pursuit of the majesty of the universe, of the paradox and the beauty inherent therein. And so he became famous, of course, with the famous general theory of relativity, which we're going to talk about, right, Armand?
General relativity. He had part of the negative part about him was he encouraged so much about development of the atomic bomb.
Well,
we have to mention that as well, because he thought the Germans were going to have it in 1939. And he cautioned us, he said, be careful, you have to develop atomic bombs because the Germans are going to have that soon.
Really? See, I thought that Einstein was about peace. I thought that his intention was to pursue science, not warfare. And so that whatever he discovered, that then was used to create weapons was really not on him,
mm-hmm.
even though he made it possible. I don't know that part about him, but why don't we talk about the theory of relativity, because it is a fascinating thing.
It's fascinating. It's just an amazing thing. Here's what we have now. We have a world that is looking at me and you and separateness. And we say, there goes an animal running across the savannah. I will kill that animal, and I will eat that animal, and I am not related to that animal, other than that animal may give me indigestion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's it.
And that's one level of reality. It is real. On one level, it's absolutely real.
Einstein says, well, no, this thing that you find is a separateness between you and everybody else, if you broke down all the elements, if you took you and that animal across the savannah and the savannah itself and the trees and the birds and everything else, and we broke it down, we would break it down to particles that were all identical.
It's as if we were all in a pot of soup. And we're all, I'm a pea in the soup, you're a piece of carrot, and that person is an onion, but we're all in the same soup, and we're all made of the same stuff, and we're all suspended in the same medium. I think the pot of soup really gives a good visual, Armand. And so if you look at us from the perspective of our own eyesight, we all look different, separate individuals with never a possibility to merge. If you look at us from the perspective of atomic and subatomic particles, you cannot actually distinguish who is you and who is me and who is the desk and who is the animal that runs across the savannah. We're all just vibrations of energy.
Now, the way Einstein measured this was he took mass, and he said if you accelerate mass, if you could look at mass and you could accelerate it, you could find that all mass can be accelerated into energy.
Yes, he basically said that energy, E for short, equals matter, mass, which is a lowercase m, times c squared, which is the speed of light in a vacuum. So what he's saying is that if you could take any piece of matter, anything that's solid, any object, a person, a cat, a desk, a table, a telephone, a computer, and you could take the particles of which that thing is made, and you could accelerate the particles to the speed of light, that object would transform back into the energy that it originally was, because everything originally comes from the same inexhaustible source of energy. And this is where the theory of relativity and every other theory in physics collapses. Everything collapses right there, because yes, you can explain how things behave, but when you go and look at why or how that happens, none of these theories can explain how come energy generates itself, and there is an endless source of it. And so, if you accelerate a telephone to the speed of light and it reverts back to energy, okay, then you can slow it down again and it becomes a football or something. It's all the same stuff that takes on a zillion different forms.
So, by his formula, E equals mc squared, we were able to put a connection, a relationship between energy and matter. And it is through that we're able to understand many things, many, many, many things. And formulas were able to be devised, like how much energy would be yielded by a certain amount of mass, or how much mass would be yielded by a certain amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes interesting because you now have a direct formula that worked. That worked 99% of the time. Now, let me talk about formulas and science and research, and I want to talk about the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis, N-U-L-L hypothesis, is a very interesting concept in science. If you had a belief that something is true, coffee makes you nervous, and that's your belief, that's your theory, and you wanted to test this theory, the way you test it is you do not test to see if a person gets nervous, but you test to find out if people don't get nervous. You take the null hypothesis. You take the opposite hypothesis. The opposite hypothesis is people do not get nervous from coffee. So if you want to prove that people get nervous from coffee, the scientific way to prove it is to get the null hypothesis, which is people do not get nervous from coffee, and you try to prove that. And what you're trying to prove, what you're trying to do is you want to find out, now you give people coffee, and you notice that their energy rises, or they get nervous, or they feel certain things, or their brainwaves spike, and you say, oh, look, it's not true. People who drink coffee do get nervous. I am disproving the null hypothesis. By disproving the null hypothesis, I am proving a hypothesis. Does that almost make sense, Roberta?
It does.
I've wrapped my mind around this so many times as a kid when I was doing research. It is such a brilliant way of looking at things. In fact, we don't look at something to be accurate 100% of the time. We look to see if something is accurate 1 out of 20 times to give it statistical significance. It's called 5%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the 1% level, there's a certain significance. At the 5% level, there's certain significance. So we want to prove things. When you take the theory of relativity and you work on it, it is proven statistically in most cases.
And
of course, then comes
the
when it doesn't work.
Oh, of course.
And then it comes.
I think that one of the things it did for people, Armand, is you have to remember, we have to remember that up until right around that time, the Cartesian view of the universe had been in place, it's also known as the mechanistic view, which is, you know, that the universe is like a clock and that things are function according to fixed laws that are immutable and always true, and things, you know, are always predictable in that sense, and that things that are solid, and that certainly there was no concept that energy and matter could be interchangeable. So it really opened up humanity's mind and awareness to all sorts of possibilities that up until that point had been unthinkable. And it was truly, in my opinion, the beginning of the New Age, not in the New Age sense of, you know, the fashionable thing, but in the sense that there is an awareness now in people, Armand, that was not there before this theory became available.
And the theory became available around 1905.
Right, the beginning of the 19th century, yeah. Mm. Although it started,
The 20th century.
Yes, I'm sorry, the 20th century. The whole thinking that led to that development of that theory, of course, starts in the Middle Ages. But it culminates around the beginning of the 1900s, and that's where things started to change, yes, in the scientific world, yes, in physics, but mostly, most importantly, in my view, in the minds and souls and hearts of people.
You know, it may be, I'm willing to bet that romance kind of evolved with some kind of consciousness about how we're all connected.
Right.
You know, because romance comes out of the Romantic Ages, you know, in Europe.
I think you have a point there.
Early 20th century, here we're discovering this thing about, we're all kind of connected. And suddenly romance starts to flower as a concept, you know.
You mean flower power?
No, not yet. That was later in the 60s. But what I think, why Albert Einstein, why did this young 20-year-old weird guy with no socks make such a difference? Because his mind was not in the structure. It wasn't there. He wasn't there. Let me tell you my Albert Einstein joke.
Please do, Armand.
You know my Albert. Here's my Albert
Einstein. I'm not sure I do.
Albert Einstein is working at his home, mm-hmm, in Germany, wherever he was. Vienna. I'm sure he was in Vienna. No, he's in America. Of course he's in America.
Well, he's been in both places.
He's in America, right. And he's in America, and he's with his wife. And he's paving. He's putting some cement out on the walk outside. And some kids come and they start moving through the cement and they're writing their names in the cement. And he comes out of his house and he's yelling at him and screaming at him, get away from my cement. Get away. Let that harden. Get away from my cement. Stop writing in it. And his wife says, Albert, what are you doing? What are you yelling at children? You love children. He says, I love children in the abstract, but not in the concrete.
No, I never heard that before. Oh, thank you for sharing that with us. I like it.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Hati. We're talking about Albert Einstein. And we're not only talking about Albert Einstein, we're talking about unified field theory, which we'll be coming to in a little bit, and how it relates to us and our hearts.
But we have so many juicy little things to say about the theory of relativity.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Time. Well, do you know anything about how does time relate
to... Yeah, that's so exciting because...
I mean, Einstein's Dreams was a beautiful little book. Do you remember this little
book? I sure do. Alan, what's the name of the author? Alan
It doesn't
something.
Matter. It's off in space.
Yes.
It's all the same. His name could be Schwartz, and it would be the same as anything else.
That's true, Armand. It's true. It is off in space. Okay, well, you see, the thing is, Einstein was fascinated with light. He kind of figured out that light, if one could understand how light behaves, what it is, what it does, how to measure it, how to work with it, one could understand a lot of things. And indeed, his theory of relativity is based on his research about light. One of the things that stems right out of the theory of relativity, if I understand it correctly, is that at the speed of light, since light moves so fast that it covers, you know, 186,000 miles per second, something like that, so it covers an enormous distance in a very short amount of time, if one could travel at the speed of light, time would shrink down to almost nothing. So forever after the theory of relativity was gifted to the world, we have a kind of a marriage between light and time, whereby whenever you're looking at light, time disappears. And so time has become a very relative concept, and it has a lot less power over humanity than it did before we knew.
You know, and I don't know, Roberta, I mean, I know this is clear to you and me, and I wish I could get this clear to people, and I hope that people are understanding the importance of what we're saying as to what the difference in perception is. When you remove time as a concrete object, and you say, oh, yes, it is clearly time is 1 hour, it's 60 minutes, it's 60 seconds per minute, and it's exact, and it's... And we take
That's
that out.
It's a construct.
It's a construct. And it's an artificial construct. And we take it and we use it universally. We believe that time exists.
Right, but it's amazing how much we believe that it exists. And it really does not, because really all there is now, and that sounds like an awful cliche, but there is no from here to there. It's all here. See? There is no in an hour or an hour ago. Everything in an hour ago is all here, right here. And there's only the now. There's nothing else.
That's why you shouldn't worry about charging everything on your credit card.
Absolutely.
Because you're
not.
Never going to have to pay the bill. Oh, no, you have to pay now.
Right.
And actually, you have to pay yesterday.
That's the point, exactly.
Alan Lightman
right,
was his name.
Right,
of
Alan
all
Lightman,
things, talking
right,
about
right.
light. Alan Lightman wrote Einstein's Dreams, and let me recommend, if you have never read this, he created a series of vignettes that describe some dreams that Einstein could have had if Einstein was working the different ways that people have perceived time.
Mm-hmm.
So he was trying to understand the mysteries of relativity, space, and time, and each vignette in the book contained a world that behaved according to a particular model of perception of time and space.
Yeah, it's a fascinating little book, and it really gets your mind to stretch and contract and bend whichever way imaginable when you start to think about these possibilities. But you know, Armand, you did mention...
Well, talk about some of the possibilities so people can get excited about the book, because I want everybody to read it.
Well, for instance, if you could slow down your time so much that everything was always in slow motion around you, except that your perception remains the same, so that you're moving at a normal speed, but everything else around you is in very slow motion, and so that, you know, the way that you would interact with your world, if that were the case, or
the one I like,
if you could stop time.
The one I like is this: imagine that you were born with the lifespan of a mosquito. And, you know, a mosquito that lives for one day.
Mm-hmm.
So he said some of the mosquitoes are born in the morning and die at night. And some of the mosquitoes are born at night and they die in the morning. So for certain mosquitoes, your perception of half of your life is you are brought up and you mate and you find your partner in darkness from the minute you hatch. And the first half of your life is all about being in the dark. And then as you get old, it gets lighter and lighter and lighter, and as you die, it becomes the ultimate light.
Mm-hmm.
So you move towards the light as part of death.
Right.
And he says the opposite of that is if you're born during the light, and your whole life is all light, and then as it gets darker, you start to die.
Hmm.
And your life is only one day long.
Hmm.
And how that would affect you. But it's all light or all dark. Anyway, the book is Einstein's Dreams by Alan Lightman. It's a fascinating book. I promise you, you will enjoy this. 1993, do you know that?
1993, it was written?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
So...
Okay, well, I was just going to say, Armand, when you said it's easier said than explained, did you mean the concept that time shrinks at the speed of light? Is that what you meant that
yes.
we should try to explain? Actually, there's a very simple way that I got from your friend...
Peter Russell.
He has a book, very good book, called From God to Science, From Science to God. And he creates a bridge exactly like that between philosophy and science, and it's very interesting. It's a great book. And he gives this visual, which I think is very effective. He gives a visual of a bicycle that's moving at 5 miles per hour, and he says, okay, so if I'm in a car and I'm about to pass this bike and I'm moving at 20 miles per hour, relative to the bicycle, I'm moving at 15 miles per hour. This is something that generally most people can get right away. Should I tell the next half of it after the break, Armand?
I think we may have to.
That's fine. So just hold that thought. The bike is moving at 5 miles per hour, and I'm moving at 20 miles per hour. Relative to the bike, I'm moving at 15 miles per hour.
The bike is moving at 5 miles an hour. You're moving at 15 miles
per hour. At 20 miles per hour.
20 miles an hour. So relative to the bike, you're moving at 15 miles
right.
an hour.
Right. I'm passing the bike at 15 miles an hour because the bike is moving at 5.
The rest of the explanation can't take more than a minute.
It's up to you. I can go for it right now.
Go for it.
Okay. So now if you take light, which moves at 186,000 miles per second, I know it's kind of a little bit of a stretch, but let's apply the same idea. I'm on a bike, and here comes light, and it passes me. Technically, it should pass me at 186,000 miles per second minus 5 miles per hour, because everything is relative like that, except that that doesn't apply to light. Even if I was moving at 180,000 miles per hour on my bike, light would still be passing me at the same speed. So the speed of light is not relative. It's an absolute.
There you have it.
It's a constant.
There you have it. We're going to take a short break faster than the speed of light. When we come back, we'll continue and we'll explain the unified field theory to you ad nauseum. We'll be right back.
We are so wet, so close, so quiet. listening to BAI New York, BAI New York, San Manali.
Talkback is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas, heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's Talkback right here on WBAI New York.
This is Armand DeMille with you. It's a positive mind. Roberta Maria Atti here on Pi Day. Pi Day 314, named after Albert Einstein, and therefore we are bringing to you some information brought to us by Albert Einstein and what that's all about. You know, Einstein's theory of relativity is what we were just talking about, and I think one of the great quotes. He said, if you could sit for 2 hours with a wonderful person, he said, the time speeds by very quickly. It seems like 2 minutes. He said, but if you sit for 2 minutes on a hot stove, it seems like eternity. You're listening to Alex Cortez, Fingerprints. And so this is Armand DeMille. You know, another quote from Albert Einstein that I've always liked. I don't know if it makes sense to you. He said, if I had only known, I would have become a locksmith. Because he loves to figure things out. And that's it. It was all about figuring things out. So relativity is the idea that things are related. You know, and that things are related by this formula of mass and energy, and that we have some kind of thing that works most of the time to understand the relationship between mass and energy.
Yes, and it represents his attempt at explaining, at finding a way to explain things that would apply 100% of the times, and of course that's not the case. In fact, there is no theory to this day that applies to everything 100% of the times. And one of the worst troublemakers is the gravity theory. That one seems to mess up every other theory that people have ever come up with.
Well, we're going to talk about gravity theory from two different levels.
Mm-hmm.
First, let's talk about it, physical gravity. Go ahead, Roberta.
Why
does that make no sense?
Gravity was, of course, defined by Newton in the sense that he came up with the whole mathematical expression of it. He was the first one who was able to give us a mathematical way of measuring gravity by measuring, I believe, the velocity at which things fall relative to their weight when you drop them from a certain altitude. And so once that equation was understood, now we have a way of measuring all kinds of things, and I think, and I'm sure that this is still what they use at NASA to send out.
It's Newtonian physics.
Yeah, to send a rocket into space, they have to use that equation, actually.
If something weighs 10,000 pounds, if you drop a car from a building or you drop a pen from a building, they still fall at 22 feet per second. That's the theory, that no matter how big the mass, it's going to fall at the same speed.
And what that gives us is the ability to overcome this force. And so we can fly in a plane. We can overcome it because we understand that equation, that relationship between the force that attracts everything to the center of the Earth and the weight of things.
Gravity. It's just infallible, isn't it?
It is. And it was believed that there was something at the center of the Earth that attracted everything to itself.
I remember a woman about 60 years old who had, she was a very small person. She was about 5 foot tall. And somebody said to her, "How does your body stay in such great shape?" And she said, "Gravity." Because she's lowered to the ground. She said, the taller you are, the more it falls.
Oh, well, it makes sense, actually.
It just makes a lot of sense.
It does. So,
however,
gravity was accepted, the theory put forth and the mathematical equation was accepted because it works in terms of its applications to the concrete world and what we need to do with it. But when you go into the reasoning mind and the tries to understand the deeper layers of reality, gravity no longer works. Why? Because it contradicts one of the most basic, if not the most basic, laws of physics, which is that energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be changed into something else.
And for every force in nature, there's an equal and
opposite
force, which is another theory that gets defied by gravity, because gravity goes one way.
Right. So, let me just see if I can explain this. If energy can only be exchanged, you know, it changes form and shape, but it cannot be created or destroyed, then how can you explain that the force of gravity, for instance, the one that holds the moon in place, because the moon, according to this theory, stays there because of the gravity of the Earth, how do you explain that the Earth is able to maintain this force activated all the time with no need for renewal of it, and there's no source, we can't find the source of this energy? It takes a lot of energy to hold the moon in place. The moon should be flying
right. The moon is being held in place.
By gravity.
How? It's not going up. It's not going out into the stratosphere. It's not coming in.
How is that possible?
It's just being held there by gravity itself, Mr. G.
And it takes a lot of energy. Mr. G, there we go, Mr. G.
Armand.
Armand figured it out. The unified field theory.
It's
Mr. G.
Well, God, G, you know, holds
right.
The moon in place.
You're right. I mean, I think we end up there because where else can we go? I mean, how does the Earth maintain this much energy expenditure that's required to keep us all attached to itself and to keep the moon there and everything else, where does it get this endless source of energy? How is it generated? It's not possible to explain. And that goes directly against that very important law that says that energy cannot be created or destroyed. So how do we explain that? Well, no one's been able to.
So now let me move that on to a little about the psychological part of this as well. Gravity. Gravity, how grave is things? You know, how seriously do you take things? How deeply do things really affect you? Think about pain. Think about grave. Think about of how grave things could be, how serious things could be. You get passed over for a job. Albert Einstein got kicked out of school. You know what I mean? He got passed over for a promotion. If you take this as very, very serious, if you give it a lot of gravity, and you say, oh, it's very grave, right? Then you wind up sunk beneath the gravity of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are the other people who look at it and say, well, that's an opportunity for me. I think I'll go move on to something else.
Mm.
And so
you defy the
gravity of the situation.
Interesting.
Depression itself is gravity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, what is depression? Depression is gravity.
Yes, there's a force that pulls you down.
You feel yourself being pulled down.
Hmm.
And yet we know there is the opposite to that. We know that there is something that says, no, it's not just down. Because if we were all, you know, I think Freud had a theory that we were thanatophilic. Thanatophilic means that we were attracted to death. We're attracted to really sinking, and that we're all kind of aiming for this huge depressive void, and we're struggling our way out of it.
Because we don't want to admit it?
Because that's the natural slide of things, like gravity.
Well, Freud was not exactly a happy camper, was he?
No, he wasn't. He was going around with his wife's sister, I think.
Oh, is that what was happening?
That was Freud, very well. Well, you know, Albert Einstein said, before God, we are all equally wise and equally foolish. Now, God becomes the next solution to this. If you say, well, if it's not gravity, who's holding the moon in place, Mr. G? We say God is holding it in place. Because that's what we used to do to explain everything. Imagine if you were back on old Savannah. Where does everybody come from, Georgia? If you were back on the Savannah and you really believed that the reason for everything, the reason the log fell out of the tree and crushed your brother on the head and he died, was because you couldn't figure it out. You didn't know anybody named Newton, you know? So you don't know why did that log come down and hit this guy on the head and kill my brother.
Mm-hmm.
So then you had to create something to explain things, and we created God.
Mm.
You know?
Oh, it was a good idea.
It's a very good idea.
Yeah, it really finds an answer for a lot of things that cannot be answered for.
Who did it?
Who invented God?
No, who did it? Who did what? Who did everything?
Oh, no one. There's no one there.
So it must be God. Now, I'm not saying there is no God. But God is an invention, is a creation of a non-science.
You're going to get in trouble, Armand.
With whom?
With people who are pro-God.
Roberti, do you know what I learned yesterday?
What did you learn yesterday?
I never knew this. You're going to love this as a Catholic. Do you know that according to the second the second Bible, that the Catholic Church now has allowed that even Jews can go to heaven?
Oh, since when? There must be a date for this. This is a very important event.
I know. I didn't know.
What about babies that are not baptized?
Yeah, we had Frank Yeoman here yesterday, and he said that according to the second something, and he's Catholic as well, he said now all non-Catholics are allowed into heaven.
Well, you see, Armand, the Pope is really the representative of God on earth, so he has the power to do things like that. If he decides that now everybody else is going to go to heaven even though they're not Catholic, he can do that.
So according to what we know about science and public opinion, we can adjust our God belief. You see, we can adjust it.
Sure.
And it's the same as the unified field theory.
By the way, I'm not Catholic. You said you being Catholic, for the record. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, unified field theory, it leads to God, because where else can it go? There is no way that we can take all of this abstract thinking that people do, intelligent folks. There is not one set of theories that prove the same thing. They all conflict with one another.
But do
That's
you understand the,
problem. The
need to do it? You understand Albert Einstein, poor Al, is sitting there in his room and he's saying there is a theory. There must be a unified field theory. He died in what, 1956 or so. He's working at it day and night, numbers on the board, right?
Yep.
He's got it working, it is going to work. He's going to find one unifying principle that brings everything together. In a sense, God, or innocence, God.
In a sense, what every physicist is searching for is the one theory that can accommodate every other theory that came before. So a theory that can accommodate gravity and quantum physics and electromagnetism and everything else that explains how things work, everything else that is coherently organized within this one theory. And the universe works is in such a way, it's so paradoxical that whenever you think you got a solid foothold onto some theory that finally works when applied to whatever, you'll find that there's that one exception where that theory does not work at all. And in fact, it contradicts itself.
And it blows you out of the water, because we need to find theories. Just think about it, friends. As a kid, you look and you say to yourself, why is this the way it is? How can my mother be so mean to me? How could she be hitting me when she said she loves me? How could she be doing this bad thing when she says this is good? How could my father be, and you look at your parents and you say, how could they be? And you try to explain it in a child's mind. And the child's mind is always trying to make sense out of things. Always.
That's true. And the child is always looking for the unified field theory.
And the child doesn't get it. So what the child gets is a parent saying to it, you cannot understand because you're too young. And the child almost welcomes that information. Oh, I can't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
See, some children.
Right.
And they hope they could go into the dull land of not understanding, but most children don't. They still ask the question. And then you grow up, and then you become somebody who's, let's say you're dating. And you're dating and you go out with five different guys who you find the most attractive. And you're a woman and you go out with five guys. And all these guys beat you up. They either beat you up, or they abuse you, or they do something to you. And you say, I've learned something. I should not go out with those guys who I find to be the sexy bad boys. From now on, I'm only going out with guys who went to college and wear shirts and ties. And you go out with one of them, and then they beat you up. In some way, they abuse you. And you say, oh, my theory didn't work. I have to modify my theory.
I have to find a bigger theory that includes
this, too. I have to find a bigger
too.
Theory that includes guys who wear shirts and ties.
That beat up people.
That beat me up. Maybe it's something about the perfume I wear. I should not wear this perfume before I go out to meet people. And we're always trying.
It's true, Armand. You're so true what you're saying.
And we're always trying to make sense by creating a belief.
But isn't this how we grow?
This is the way we grow, yes.
And that's really, you talked about children, and that's how children grow eventually, but we never stop. We keep trying. We keep trying. And I don't know about you, but I keep finding, even when I get to a point where I finally figure something out, and I'm really, I think, wow, now I got it. This works. I can apply this. The next day, something happens to disprove me that solution I had found works, except for this one situation.
Oh, Roberta, so many times people have said to me, Armand, why aren't you published? I mean, I've got one book published, but people said, why don't you write what you believe? And that's exactly what happens to me.
What do you mean?
I'll write it down today, and I'll learn something tomorrow that'll say, oh, no, that wasn't true.
Right.
That which I believed a day ago.
Oh, I know what you mean.
Was not true. And I have looked back on some of the things that I've written,
absolutely.
And I say, oh, this is good. And so I went to somebody who was a writer recently and looked at it and said, oh, this is good stuff. I said, yeah, but it's not true. something I wrote. I said, but it's not true anymore because I learned differently than that.
Isn't that true?
And so how can you...
So embarrassing, too, sometimes.
So sometimes I wonder about all the great writers, you know, and I remember, who was it that wrote The Road Less Traveled?
Kerouac.
No.
No, no. Oh, Scott Peck.
Scott Peck, right?
Scott Peck.
By the time he finished his book, The Road Less Traveled, the first one, he had discovered a way of taking yourself on a voyage. But halfway through that book, he had discovered Jesus.
Oh, boy.
You know? Hmm. Halfway through that book. But meanwhile, he finished that book and sent it out the way it was. But meanwhile, he got on a whole other trip, and I was a born-again Christian or something like that. Hmm. And he wrote a second book of being a born-again Christian.
Amazing.
But then, halfway through that book, he discovered something else.
Exactly. That's what we're saying, that the unified field theory may be that everything is slippery and nothing is real. There we go. That includes everything, Armand. You can't, it doesn't, you know. That
well, how about this? Everything is slippery and real. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's real or unreal.
Everything is slippery and both real and unreal.
That's
I'll
right.
settle for that.
How about just everything is slippery?
Okay.
I'll go with that, too.
Deal.
Yeah.
Okay. We have it, people.
We have our book.
You can announce it.
We have a three-word book.
And
everything is
on
slippery.
Pi Day 2007, it's an important date.
On Pi Day 2007,
we've discovered the
Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Atti have discovered the unified field theory in three words. Everything is slippery.
Congratulations, Armand.
You know, is that it?
We arrived.
I think it's fun for you, my friends, to go through Albert Einstein's achievements, his writings, his poetry, some of the things that he had to say, to just kind of understand.
He was actually
the
a poet,
of that
too.
Mind. Yes, he was quite a poet.
Yeah, he really was good at it, too.
Yeah. And I think it's really worthwhile. Since we now have one other thing that is helping us with defy all of the unified field theory, which is we have information. We have information like we've never had information before. So wherever we think there's an unshakable theory, we could just look in the computer and say...
Isn't that remarkable?
You know, I mean, it's just...
You know, I'm getting more and more to the point, Armand, where every time I'm on the Internet looking at for something, doing some work, I realize that what I'm really accessing is the brain of humanity. It's right there in the form of a little machine, but hey... You have access to all of the knowledge that humans have accumulated.
Do you think Einstein
at the fingertips
even thought of this at one point,
I
that the unified
know.
Field of knowledge?
I don't
the
even...
The Internet is unified field theory in so many ways.
I don't even think that people who invented the Internet and started to develop it realized what they were doing until much later. And I think, in fact, that people are starting to realize it now, where we've had it for, what, 30 years? It's been around a while. But the implications of it have not really dawned on us until now, where we're realizing... My goodness, I'm connected to every other person on Earth, just about, and I have access to all of the knowledge that every human has ever come up with from day one.
And this radio program searches out all over the world now.
It's amazing.
Everywhere, every part, a corner of the globe, people are sending us letters back,
See,
telling
I'm
us
on...
how they relate to this. I know, now you're excited, right?
Well, because that gives me hope.
Lots of hope.
Yeah, the fact, you know, things can look really bleak if you listen to the news, if you look at all these different things that are happening. But when you realize that people are getting together like this on a very, very, well, technological level, but soul level, that's what I think, it gives me a lot of sense of closeness and unity with everyone else on Earth that I don't think was possible before this time.
Two bits of information related to that. Number one, so the other day I was out of touch with my computer for 4 days, and I came back to 1,762 emails, a majority of which are spam. So since I have BrainLink...
That's the downside
right,
of the...
BrainLink, right, the downside of it. I call up my friend over at BrainLink, and I say, Raj, you got to help me. what am I going to do, change my email address? He said, oh, no. He said, I just developed this filter. He said, let me press this button. He presses a button, and it eliminates all of the spam. I now get 10 to 15 emails. And he, with one button, he had finally developed the way to undo it.
That's the other thing. It keeps getting more and more perfect, more and more efficient, more and more far-reaching. It's amazing.
And we are. And this is Armand DeMille, so my special regards. Have a piece of pie today, my friends, in honor of the birthday boy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to listen to today's program, you could go to thepositivemind.com or WBAI.org or Roberta Atti at
creativehealthsolutions.org.
I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Do you know why there are 13 donuts in a baker's dozen?
No.
Because people used to be afraid that they'd get persecuted, in some way prosecuted, for shortchanging. So they threw an extra donut in.
Wow, that's interesting, Armand.
Happy birthday, birthday boy, on Pi Day. And we're so happy to celebrate that with you and with all of you. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, listener-supported, commercial-free community radio. Coming up next at 2 p.m. will be Light Show with Vic the Bruiser. Talk back with Hugh Hamilton at 3 p.m. Behind the News with Doug Henwood. That is tomorrow, Behind the News. Just thinking about Doug Henwood. Doug Henwood with Behind the News. That's tomorrow at 5 p.m. But this evening at 5 p.m., Exploration, Science, and Peace Issues with Dr. Michio Kaku and the WBAI Evening News at 6 p.m.
We are safer because we are on the offense against our enemies overseas.
It's already 4 years since the war in Iraq began, and today there's no apparent end in sight.
We're safer because of the skill and sacrifice of the brave Americans who defend our people.
Hi, I'm Mario Murillo, host of the Friday edition of Wake Up Call, inviting Long Island listeners to a special community forum and debate on Wednesday, March 21st at 6:30 p.m. at the Monroe Lecture Hall of Hofstra University in Hempstead, Long Island. We'll bring together voices from various sectors to examine the state of the war and the options for an end to the conflict. Peace activists, policy analysts, academics, students, and a number of Iraq war veterans will debate the president's escalation and the justification for the war. Speakers include historian Carolyn Eisenberg, Leslie Kagan of United for Peace and Justice, and Rob Timmons of Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America, among many others. That's Wednesday, March 21st at 6:30 p.m. at the Monroe Lecture Hall in the South Campus of Hofstra University. For more information, call 516-463-5667. I hope to see you there.
The people of this country voted last November to stop the war. Bush's answer has been more war. If he attacks Iran, we will all wake up in a world that we no longer recognize. It's up to the people of America to stop him. Saturday, March 17th, we will head to Washington, D.C. for the first march in 2 decades to surround the Pentagon. Bush says the Iraq war will not stop on his watch. Then we must end his watch. Impeach Bush and Cheney for war crimes. March on the Pentagon. Buses will be leaving from Manhattan and the surrounding boroughs. For information, go to www.nyc.worldcan'twait.org or call 347-678-5905 to purchase tickets. Again, that's 347-678-5905. The world can't wait. The hour is late. What will you do? March on the Pentagon, March 17th.
Talkback is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday, from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Just a few seconds before 2 p.m., you are tuned to 99.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.